Hi there, welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. Loads to talk about in our latest show. We've got the Guinness Festival at Newmarket to look back on, the Punchy Sound Festival, some worrying news on the politics and industry front in Britain, and also big breaking news in relation to a new international racing competition. My name is Lee Mottis, and I'm joined in the studio by Jonathan Harding. Hello, Jonathan.
Morning, Lee.
We will be talking about Jonathan's trip to the Punchy Sound Festival and also some of the racing that took place there as well, not just his trip. But first of all, we are going to start with a big global racing story that broke on Monday morning. It relates to plans for a new global jockeys league involving 12 of the world's highest profile riders that is set to launch, according to organisers, in early 2026, so early next year. The 12 jockeys who are signed up to this are Ryan Moore, James McDonald, William Buick, Frankie Dettori, Christophe Lemaire, Zach Purton, Yataki Taki, Irad Ortiz Jr., Mikhail Barcelona, Joe Moreira, Flavien Prat and Vincent Ho. Crucially, according to this competition, those 12 riders will in effect be shareholders in the business and therefore are committed to taking part in what is expected to be, once the thing gets properly up and running, up to 10 race meetings every year that will take place at some of the sport's most prestigious venues. There will be six races at each fixture. It'll be a global, it'll be a points-based format with those 12 jockeys taking part in every race. And ultimately, again, once things are really up and running, the ambition is that they'll be racing for a total prize pool of $15 million US dollars. That's the early take on what is planned. You can get more details on the Racing Post digital platforms as we speak. Now, Jonathan, what is your early take on this?
I think my first reaction is that it's an interesting concept. Yeah. I think a lot of these things are floated in racing and they almost get killed before they're given a chance to get off the ground. So I'm hopeful that this will come to fruition. It sounds like it will. And it's tapping into, I think, the trend of global racing, particularly on the flat. We've seen it with the World Pool, we've seen it with the emergence of all these racing jurisdictions and the link up between them all in the way that's quite logical global calendar now. And to tap into that by using the big personalities in the saddle, I think, is a logical step and hopefully something that will sort of appeal to an existing racing audience and, as they say, kind of attract the next generation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They've certainly got some big names in there. James McDonald, who will be the biggest name in the Southern Hemisphere. Ryan Moore, the biggest name over here. He says in one of his quotes, "I'm excited about the prospect of being able to contribute to generating increased interest in the sport of horse racing globally." William Buick, who we'll be talking more of later in the show, says, "I think we all realise we need to drive change in the way our sport is marketed globally. The league is an amazing concept, and the ownership model will allow me to use my profile to grow awareness of the sport across a broader audience in the years ahead." So that's, I think, that ownership aspect of it is an interesting part of this project. I think the organisers and the co-founders are John Ferguson, who is a BHA board member, former chief executive of Godolphin, and Lachlan Fitt, who's got a long and extensive backstory in gaming, wagering in the Southern Hemisphere. They have created this business so that these 12 founding jockeys, and you like, all have a stake in the business. Mm-hmm. So they're motivated to try and grow it. They are the team principals of their own team. They will race at every fixture in every race in their own silks. So Ryan Moore will have his own silks. James McDonald will have his own silks. The Everest in Australia, which has succeeded in getting a very young crowd, a young fan base. And they believe that is due to that race's enormous prize pool. And they think that the prize pool in this, if they get to $15 million and they're chasing commercial backers now, that will drive interest. Does that sound logical to you?
Yeah, it all sounds very sensible, particularly the buy-in of the jockeys, because there's nothing worse than having a jockeys challenge or a series or a team-based competition and you float all these big names and then they don't show up because they've got to ride somewhere else. The fact that they're invested in it and presumably obliged to ride in all of the meetings means that you're getting that kind of story throughout the whole competition, as opposed to, I mean, barring injury, obviously, but as opposed to people dropping in and out and replacements and what have you. So I think that's very sensible. I think there's certainly a logic to big prize money does drive engagement, particularly in the media and particularly with kind of, it just lends that gravitas to it. You know, it's a $15 million challenge. It's like a, you know, dare I say a $20 million Saudi Cup or something like that. It does add a certain element of prestige, even though it's a new competition. That probably sounds silly, but there's an element of I should care about this because of the amount of money at stake, and there's a bit of jeopardy there. If you're a jockey's riding to win all of that money, it suddenly lends a little bit of drama to it all. So I think definitely with these ideas, most of them fall by the wayside when they're not properly invested in. So it's a noble aim, and let's just see what it looks like in 2026.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of where we'll be seeing it in 2026, I know the organisers have been speaking to a variety of major world race courses. I think we're looking at possibilities of Ascot and York would be candidates in Britain, Leopardstown and the Curragh in Ireland, Chantilly and Longchamp in France, and then globally you could be looking at Caulfield or Flemington in Australia, Churchill Downs in America, and you'd imagine from what they said they want to try and build it around existing major race meetings so that they're not trying to disrupt the calendar. They won't be using, if you like, pattern class horses. They're not going to try to take horses away from the existing major races, but they will try and build it around the racing calendar, probably in the first half of the year. One aspect of it that was immediately apparent to me that would raise question marks, and others have said the same, is the absence of female jockeys in the lineup. I put that to Lachlan Fitz, one of the co-founders, who said, as we establish and then grow the league, we look forward to having the best female jockeys in the world being involved. We're evaluating a number of growth opportunities following the initial launch season that will both expand the reach of the league and see more global icons put in the spotlight. Clearly is an issue that there are no female jockeys in there. I think probably from the organiser's perspective, they might argue that, would you say that of the 12 world's top flat riders, one of them at this stage is a female jockey? You can debate that point. They might say if you put one in, it would look tokenism. But ultimately, for this to really develop, you'd imagine you must have to have female jockeys in there eventually.
Yeah, absolutely, you'd have to. And I agree with that point. I think if you're going strictly off the best jockeys, then you do that and you don't sort of throw in another name just for the sake of it, because that's almost worse than not, to my mind. But ultimately, if you're trying to attract a younger audience and you're trying to generate those stories that are really going to cut through globally, then I think you do need a little bit more, because like you said, it's a logical question that is going to be asked of it. Why is there no female representation?
Yeah. Well, that question and others will no doubt be debated further over the coming weeks. And it's a story that will be developed on Racing Post platforms as we go forward as well. We're going to take a quick break now. And when we return, lots of major racing action from the last few days to talk about. Welcome back to the front page. Jonathan Harding and myself here at Racing Post HQ debating, looking at some of the big issues from the sport in recent days. And there have been loads of fantastic action on the track, John. Newmarket was where I was for the last couple of days for the Guineas Festival at headquarters. And it was the story of Godolphin, with Team Godolphin winning both the 2,000 guineas and the 1,000 guineas, with Ruling Court on Saturday and Desert Flower on Sunday. But remarkably, Godolphin also were victorious in the Kentucky Derby on Saturday night, having won the Kentucky Oaks on Friday night. So four classics across around about 46 hours for Godolphin. Hugh Anderson, the managing director of Godolphin in the UK and Dubai, described it as the most tremendous weekend in Godolphin's history. Hard to argue with that.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about the number of things that have to go right to win one classic.
Yeah.
And to win two, and then three, and then four. You're extrapolating the odds, aren't you, to such an extent that is just a... I mean, it's almost inconceivable that would happen. And it's credit to them, of course, and four very good horses.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of those horses, if we concentrate on the Newmarket champions, Ruling Court won what was... not a controversial 2,000 guineas, but a 2,000 guineas that felt as much a story about a horse who didn't win as one who did win. Because Field of Gold looked an unlucky loser at the time. John Gosden, when we spoke to him on Saturday, described it in terms of the comparison with Field of Gold's father, Kingman, who lost the guineas in frustrating circumstances. He said it was not dissimilar to that. It looked as though perhaps Kieran Schumacher, had he been able to ride the race again, would have ridden it a different way. And to his great credit, on Sunday, he came out, spoke on ITV, and basically fronted up to that and said that mistakes were made during the race. I think he's very commendable. Did Field of Gold look to you an unlucky loser at the 2000 guineas?
Yeah, I think I think possibly the best horse finished second, but that's not to take anything away from the winner, who got a fantastic ride off William Buick and is clearly a very good horse in his own right, don't get me wrong, but I sense Field of Gold, if you ran that race again, or indeed if it were 20 yards further, would have won. You know, he will have his day, possibly over a mile and a quarter. He looks as though stepping up in trip will be perfect for him as well. And just on Kieran Schumacher, I thought that was fantastic for him to come out and and give that analysis, because there has previously been this almost, there has been a certain reluctance to be critical of rides. And in every other sport, you know, if Rory McIlroy shanks one into the bushes or Harry Kane misses an open goal, then it's fair game to criticise that action without criticising the person.
Exactly.
And I think sometimes there's a certain, almost people shy away from criticising a ride because it's taken as criticism of the jockey. Now, that is within a fair boundary, because people do take it further and they go on to, and it gets silly, as it did on social media, which typically as it did on social media. But for him actually to come out and say, look, if I had my time again, this is what I'd have done. This is the thinking behind why I did what I did. And we're talking, you know, I think he was arguably a little bit unfair on himself, because he was talking like a split second decision. And, you know, he wasn't, it was a tiny margin, as it is over a mile at Newmarket, you know, it's, but again, to his credit that he came out and was analytical and was reflective over it. And it's great for the viewer at home who watched the race to understand what was going through his head at that point and what he was feeling underneath him. So
yeah, absolutely. You made a split second decision. I made the parallel in the piece right from Newmarket, that William Buick faced a big decision about the 2000 guineas, but that was, do I ride Shadow of Light or do I ride Ruling Court? And with that one, it was a big decision, but he had all the time in the world to make it. Kieran Schumacher's decision had to be made in a split second, and ultimately he's either got the horse in just the wrong spot in the race, not pressed go at quite the right time. But equally, he was unlucky that Field of Gold didn't pick up as quickly going into the dip as he had done on slightly easier ground in the Craven Stakes. Before going to the 1,000 guineas, Ruling Court, Derby horse, Derby favourite, Derby winner. We're not talking about Derby favourite. Line in Winter is still the Derby favourite. Do you think Ruling Court is a Derby winner in weight?
Well, gave the Line in Winter a bit of a boost, didn't it, him winning that way? He looks every bit a Derby horse. I would still probably side with the Lion in Winter without having seen him. I think it'll be all eyes on the Dante, won't it? And, and what he produces there. But he's certainly going to be there or thereabouts, you'd expect, because every bit about that performance said Derby horse. I think he's their only Derby entry as well, so they've been thinking that race for a while.
Yeah, yeah. They're also thinking about the Oxford Desert Flower. So immense confidence about her going into the 1,000 guineas. When Charlie Appleby was interviewed after the 2,000 guineas, he described her as bulletproof. You sense that they just thought she was going to win. William Buick subsequently said he couldn't see her getting beat in the 1,000 guineas.
I love that, don't you?
Yeah, it's great, that sort of bullishness. And he was proved right. workmanlike, not a scintillating winner of the Guineas, but that's maybe the sort of filly that she is. Mm. But a tremendous performance.
Yeah, and I don't mind workmanlike. I do, you know, these horses are still learning. I say it's sort of like it's become a bit of a cliche now, the final 2-year-old races of the season. But you know, she is going to improve for that run, and actually, a horse that's able to tough it out in that way and win as she did, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. I think she's certainly one to watch for the Oaks, and like you say, I love how bullish they were, and William Buick rides that horse in a bullish way. You know, he knows he's on what he believes to be the best horse, and she won accordingly, and it's so much better than we're hopeful of a big run, or the ground is good and the jockey's good and all this sort of platitudes. Actually having them come out and really back that filly is exciting, because it shows that they really think that the ceiling is incredibly high, and after what we saw there, you can, you know, any amount of improvement potentially this year.
Yeah, she was a really good winner of the 1,000 Guineas. A fabulous weekend for Godolphin, a fabulous week for Willie Mullins. We said that before once or twice in the last few months. Jonathan Arling, you were at Punchestown for the festival. Another Willie Mullins fest there. A plethora, an abundance of Grade 1 winners. But there were lots of big stories during the week there. What for you resonated most? What for you struck you most during those days at Punchestown?
Well, I mean, the fact that it really is the Willie Mullins show over there at that festival. You know, we think he dominates Cheltenham, but at Punchestown it is the Mullins show. And even if he's not winning with his first string, or in the case of some of the races, second or third string, there's a fourth there who's still better than the rest of the field and still wins at a big. I'm thinking Champ Kylie in this case, won a very strange race. But the stories that resonated, I mean, Galopin des Champs bouncing back was big. There's an enormous, you know, great atmosphere there. Fantastic performance, wasn't it? I mean, it slightly makes you think, how good is I Know the Way You're Thinking, given the way he absolutely annihilated a pretty small but select field. But they were proper horses that he was beating, and he was
stunning, wasn't he?
It was a fan. Visually. I mean, visually he's stunning anyway, even when he's not racing. But it was a fantastic performance. And then the Champion Hurdle and Constitution Hill and all the anticipation around that. It was so late in the day as well that the whole day was building up to this clash between State Man and Constitution Hill. And disappointing that we didn't maybe get the battle that we'd hoped, and that Constitution Hill ran as flat as he did. But all credit to State Man, was a fantastic performance. And Golden Ace, I feel bad actually, because I felt I should have spoken to Jeremy Scott after, but it was all about Constitution Hill. But Golden Ace ran a fantastic race in second again.
She did. But as you say, a bit like with the 2,000 Guineas, in some ways the biggest, or as big a part of the story, was a horse who didn't win. It was sad to see Constitution Hill perform like that. First time he's been beaten when he has completed a race. He didn't look initially that keen to line up. I know a few people were commenting on that, and then he's jumped the first flight a bit like a steeplechase,
which you'd imagine.
And there were times, well, down the back you wouldn't have been concerned, but really as soon as James Bowen pushed the button, there was nothing there. And you were saying to me earlier on that in the paddock after the race, you could tell he had a race.
Yes, definitely. You know, he put a lot into it, even though James Bowen sort of sat up and realised that it was sort of done and looked after him. He still looked as though he'd had a race, and it was just really, you could see the disappointment from Nicky Henderson, and fair play to him for fronting up afterwards and discussing it, and Michael Buckley the same, because they did not expect that at all. When why would you? And it's just a shame to see him put in a performance like that, because he's, I don't know, I think Henderson put it best when he said they can't talk. We can't understand why that has happened, whether those fools have left a mark. It was a heavy one at Aintree, whether there's a, I think he put it quite nicely actually, in recent days we said sort of mental and physical breaks needed. I think that's probably an accurate reflection, but it's encouraging that he's staying in training next season, and you know, be good for British racing in particular if he can bounce back to somewhere near his imperious best.
Yeah, and we shouldn't forget that State Man, who was so imperious in that race at Punchestown, had gone through his own trough this season when he was beaten by Brighter Days Ahead. Mm-hmm. He looked like a horse who was completely gone at the game. And even when he won the Irish Champion Hurdle, he seemed exhausted. And yet since then, at Cheltenham, he probably would have won the Champion Hurdle, did win this one. He looked right back to his very best.
Yeah,
so one bad performance need not mean the end of a horse's time at the top.
Exactly. And State Man's won all of these grade ones, a silly amount of grade ones, and maybe just slightly, or not gone under the radar is unfair, but he probably doesn't get the credit he deserves as a serious horse. And there is part of the very best horses, the multiple grade one winners, the Champion Hurdle winners. Yes, you have the sheer ability of a Constitution Hill, but actually for State Man to keep coming back and keep doing it and have that consistency, bar that little blip, but to keep showing up in these grade ones and doing it, part of greatness is actually durability and consistency and efficiency, and he's got all of that. I mean, it was never in doubt, really, was it?
No, it wasn't. Before we move on from Punchestown, although clearly devastating blow for Nicky Henderson and his team on Friday, they bounced right back with the Lamba on Saturday, and that was part of a wider narrative of it was a really good week for British Stables at Punchestown.
Yeah, we have to stop the boats, stop them coming over. I mean, yeah, it was in the handicaps. You know, Harry Durham having a winner there, a few others. It's good to see. It's good to see them almost reciprocate, because the Irish trainers are big supporters of Cheltenham and Aintree. Yeah. And actually, I hope that this would encourage a few more British trainers to roll the dice a bit and go and take them on, particularly in the handicaps. Okay, it's a job to take on Willie Mullins in the grade ones, but it's a job at Cheltenham and Aintree as well. It doesn't really matter where he has runners. He's going to have fancied runners. But there are opportunities in those handicaps, and I mean, if you know, you don't need me to sell a week's racing in Punchestown in terms of atmosphere and experience and everything else. It's worth going just to have a runner, but actually knowing that you can go over there and compete now is hopefully going to lead to a few more having a crack.
Yeah, and before we go on to some slightly grimmer material, we should say as well that at Punchestown and at Newmarket there's some good news on crowds front. Punchestown was heaving as ever, Friday record crowd. Newmarket had the biggest 2,000 guineas day attendance since 2017, so that's all positive stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think people are as concerned about those big days, particularly when it's a, you know, talking about bank holidays and the sun's out, and you know, we can be a little bit down on ourselves sometimes, but a day at the big racing with the good horses and the good storylines and at those sorts of tracks, I think, you know, they sell themselves to an extent, and particularly Punchestown. I mean, it's the atmosphere there was incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Great place. We are going to move on now just to look at some of the big politics and industry issues that have broken in the last 7 days. Probably three things we can wrap up in this, Jonathan. Okay, so one, the BHA produced numbers last week that showed that betting turnover had fallen 9% in the first 3 months of 2025 compared to 2024, blaming that on a variety of factors, not least affordability checks, punters moving to the black market, in line with other data that we've seen in recent months. We then had news of the Treasury and government confirming this consultation on gambling taxes, on remote online gambling taxes, and their desire to harmonise the tax that's imposed on chance-based online betting, gaming, bingo, slots, etc., and conventional betting. Gaming is at 21%, betting is at 15%. The expectation is that if the government is looking to harmonise things, it certainly won't be looking to reduce.
Drop them both to 10.
Exactly, yeah. So that is going to be bad news, potentially, for British racing, unless the sport can convince the government during the consultation process that anything that increases the tax in relation to horse racing has to be bad for the sport. And the third bit of news that came through was in the Sunday Times, suggestions that the government is looking to abolish the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which racing and betting are wrapped up at the moment, and that could have positive or negative impacts on racing and betting. So loads to to reflect on there. The betting tournament stuff is pretty much what we expected, sadly. It's everything else that we've seen.
All too predictable, unfortunately. That doesn't make it any less worrying just because we expected it, but that tallies with what we're hearing, and that tallies with the regulatory uncertainty and the impact that that's already having. There's a lot of talk about what affordability checks, the impact that they might have, and there's a lot of hypotheticals and trial periods and what have you, but it's having a very real effect already, which is hugely ominous when you think it's not sort of formally been introduced.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I'm certain that the leaders within the BHA will be using that information, those numbers, when they talk to Treasury officials and ministers about this consultation.
Well, who do they talk to?
Well,
soon?
Exactly, if the DCMS goes, but for now we know it's they'll be talking to Treasury officials. And presumably saying, well, look at these numbers. These are disastrous numbers for British racing. How can you possibly, at this time, want to make racing a less attractive product to bookmakers? Because that is bound to have a knock-on effect on the sport. Again, it's serious stuff.
It is serious stuff, and what's bad for bookmakers' profit margins is bad for racing. That's the relationship that racing has with bookmakers. The horse is slightly bolted on that one. It's symbiotic. For a long time it worked, and now looking at the impact that these things are having on bookmakers, of course there's going to be a rationalisation from their part in how they approach racing, and of course that's going to have catastrophic effects for racing's finances, and of course that's going to have catastrophic effects for racing's workforce and everything else. So it's a domino effect, and we're seeing more and more dominoes being about to be pushed over, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's not good, it's not good, it's worrying, but it's a bank holiday, and I think we should end on something positive, and that was also something that came out this morning on Monday in relation to this year's Betfred Derby, whose declaration stage will go from 40 hours to 72 hours, so that whereas last year and in previous years the field has been declared at 10 a.m. on the Thursday, this year it'll be 10 a.m. on the Wednesday, only 24 hours, but it's generally felt, I think, that with these big races, the longer people have to look forward to an event, to build to an event, to promote an event, to sell an event, to market an event, has to be a good thing. And from my perspective, and I suspect from yours, the Jockey Club should be applauded for this.
Totally agree. Yeah, ending on a good story. It doesn't sound like much, does it, 24 hours?
But
actually, 24 more hours of build-up and certainty and knowing who's going to run and developing those storylines and selling it, I think has to be a good thing. It's refreshing to see. There's a lot of talk about wholesale change and big initiatives and jockeys' challenges and all these massive things. Actually, something as sensible and small as we're just going to add 24 hours onto the declarations.
Yeah.
Great. Gives us a chance to sell it a bit more. The Derby is a Derby and it deserves a build-up. So I do hope that they're rewarded with a bit more coverage and a bit more interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know more now about the potential Derby contenders having seen the Guineas. And there'll be more to unearth at Chester and Lingfield this week, and indeed at Leopardstown as well. So you can follow all that on Racing Post platforms. Join us again on the show next week. Thanks to Jonathan for this today. Thanks to you for watching. Until next week from us, bye-bye.